Blog Talk Radio.
And good day from Fairfax, Virginia, where it's a puffy cloud, sunny, and a little bit warm and humid day here in Fairfax. This is John Gresham, and I'm here with this week's edition of Military Monday. Now, this is going to be a very special edition of Military Monday, albeit it's going to be a little shorter because our guest does have to leave in about 40 minutes. But today we have secured a very, very special guest. If you are at all involved with social media, either Twitter or with Facebook, then you have probably heard of the figure known as Doctrine Man. Most people, like myself, find him because we love his stick figure cartoons of military life around the Defense Department. He is irreverent. He is a professional in the highest order. And also, he is a teller of truth to power. And we have secured him today to come on the show with us. But we are agreeing to keep his secret identity just that, secret. And so today, from an undisclosed location somewhere deep, deep underground, I give you Doctrine Man. Sir, are you there?
We're here, John.
Okay, great. And first of all, welcome. And I guess my first question to you has to be, who is Doctrine Man? What is he? And why did you ever get the idea of doing this?
Well, you know, John, to really get to the ground truth behind why we are what we are, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's an irreverent sense of humor, something that developed over the years as something just shared among friends. And several years ago, the cartoon started as just something shared with friends over email, and kind of a way to poke fun at ourselves, driven by, I was working in the doctrine community at the time, and had heard, had a friend of mine who made a comment boy, wouldn't it be great if the Army had doctrine superheroes? And we all thought that was so funny, and then Doctrine Man grew out of that one comment. And the cartoons were really just to make fun of ourselves and, you know, make fun of what's around us. And we did that for a few years, probably about 2 or 3 years, and it got to a point where just emailing out a daily cartoon became a huge burden because of the number of people that would email and say, hey, can you add me to the list? Can you add me to the list? And I think we got to about 500 people a day that got the cartoon and said, and decided that we need to do this in a different format because it's too unwieldy for the daily email, and started the Facebook page about probably about 3 years ago. And again, even when we started that, that was intended to be a very small audience of just people within the community. But as you can see, it's grown and it grows every day, and it became something that we didn't expect, which is it went from just being humor to being a great way to share news, to open up key topics or topics of interest to discussion. And so it went from being a daily cartoon that was emailed around the cubicles in the office to what we like to look at as a formal microblog that still has a thread of humor that weaves it all together every day.
And you obviously have the page on Facebook, which, if for our friends who are going to be listening today, is obviously Doctrine Man. You know, Doctrine Man. No space between the doctrine and the man. And according to what it says here, you're flirting with 20,000 followers at this point. I think I'm pretty cool because I've got over 1,000, and here you are with 20. I mean, that's amazing to me.
Well, and I think it could. It's a modest following when you compare it to some of the other pages out there, but I look at it from the perspective that what we're trying to do here is have a community where we can have intellectual dialogue along with a laugh at ourselves sometimes, and that makes it unique. And so instead of having 100,000 followers by just posting cartoons and pictures and having fun, we're happier with a smaller number of people that jump in and we can talk about key topics. And that's really what we try to do.
And Oz, Doctor and Man, do you have superhuman powers? Do you have spidey senses or special Microsoft Office skills that the rest of us don't have? What is it that makes the Doctor and Man character tick, and why is he so effective as a communications medium in your mind?
I would say that it's all serendipity. It's nothing intentional. But if we had a single superpower, it would probably be the ability to toe the line between having fun and providing value. And it's easy to provide fun and entertain a large community. It's a lot harder to provide value. And I think that's where we have the most credibility and the most power, that people, they'll come for a cartoon and they'll stay for the dialogue. And I think that's probably a superpower that everybody would like to be able to have.
I certainly do. And I'm hoping, given the number of people showing up as guests on our listener list, it looks like we're having a good day. By the way, for our listeners, if you'd like to talk to Dr. Mann or myself or both of us, please give us a call. Our call-in number is 347-945-7246. And while we are a little limited on time today, we will try and get in callers if they do want to talk to him. And this takes us to the next step, that you've managed to go, and to some degree this has gotten a little out of hand, I think, in the sense that Dr. Mann is no longer just a character or a blog or even a Facebook or Twitter identity. It's a brand, isn't it? I mean,
it certainly has evolved into a brand. And again, that was never the idea initially. But as time passes, you recognize that people start to pick up the idea and talk about what's happening. And so you need that. You need branding to be able to cement that idea. And we, every day that goes by, we try to do a little bit better with that.
And when we say a brand, that means you've got coffee cups, you've got poker chips, you've got a variety of Dr. Mann merchandise, which can be bought and is collectible, has it not?
Absolutely. The poker chips were just an idea that seemed to have grown over time. And we try to do 3 or 4 poker chips a year. Push them out to the folks. We put them up for sale. We had a calendar last year just on a whim, and that thing proved really popular. And then, of course, about 2 months ago, we published the first year of our cartoons on Amazon, and that book's available. And we're just getting ready to personalize that. We're in the next week or so, we're going to put copies of the book up for sale that you can write in and have them personalized to you as a gift or whatever you want to do with them. But all about getting the word out, sharing the ideas. And as we said earlier, I mean, that's how you bring people into a community, where it might be the cartoon that brings them in, but once they see what's offered, they tend to stick around for the conversation.
And one last question regarding the Dr. Mann motif. You still do the cartoons, and they're wickedly funny. Sometimes they're single panel, sometimes they're 3 or 4. Why the stick figures? What caused you to create them with stick figures, and how has that evolved? I mean, I remember when, you know, Charles Schulz described the evolution of his Peanuts characters over the decades. You have stick figures. How did it start, and why did you use them?
My artistic skills border on those of a kindergartner. So stick figures were the easiest to draw. And what's the tool that we tend to use most in the military that everyone else makes fun of is PowerPoint. So I thought the best way to do this would be if you could create a stick figure in PowerPoint and then use that, because then you get the double entendre of you're making fun of yourself in two ways instead of just one, and it allows you to just kind of expand from there. And it's funny that you mentioned Charles Schulz, because if you look over the course of the last few years, the characters evolve over time, and they've changed. And just as I grew up with Peanuts, and as Peanuts, the cartoon itself and the characters changed and became more refined over time, the same thing happens with ours. We find that certain characters resonate more than others, and their looks will change over time, and our skills get a little bit better with PowerPoint. And in the last year, we introduced full color backgrounds for the first time, and we started to take the cartoon in new directions and test new ideas, new thoughts, and new methods. And so it evolves constantly, but we stay true to the fact that it stays stick figures that begin in panels of PowerPoint.
Wonderful. So in that regard, there's a little bit of inside the Beltway rules being played here. I do love that. whether you are inside the Beltway or not, we do not know. And obviously you're deep underground in a bunker somewhere. Let's talk a little bit about the things that you talk about in this microblog that is part of the whole Doctrine Man enterprise these days. I want to talk about the Force, because one of the things that clearly comes across in both what you post and what you draw is a deep underlying understanding and identity with the people, the men, the women, the kids out there in the Force doing this wonderful job and this very dangerous work. And in your own way, and again, I want to make this clear to everyone, these are personal opinions, and I want to make sure everybody knows that he is saying this on his own. But, sir, what is your current assessment of the state of our Force? How are they? Are they hurt? Are they tired? Are they beat? Are they tattered? What are they in your mind? What is the state of the Force across DOD?
There's two aspects to that answer, John. The first one is, and I think everyone would agree, that we're stretched. And we have been for the last several years. And I think that's a state that everyone will acknowledge. We've asked a tremendous amount of our service members, specifically, the Army and the Marines have carried a large burden, but the other services have too. We've asked, the nation has asked a lot of them over the last few years, and so they've been stretched. And there comes a point in time where everybody kind of wants to take a knee, take a deep breath, and get caught up. And I think we're approaching that. We're getting to that point now. The other aspect of that, and I hate to overuse a term that nobody likes necessarily, but it's resilient. We see some tremendously resilient people, and we have a very resilient Force. And that even when we've been tasked to the point where we're stretched, I think everyone can look around and say, we have seen amazing performance from people again and again, people who have deployed multiple times, still come home, done their jobs, prepared for their next deployment, gone out and done that. And that speaks volumes to their training, the leadership that they've received, and their own individual resilience. So I would say you've tasked a resilient Force, and they continue to perform. And I think everybody's probably looking forward to the day where we can take that knee again, at least, and catch our breath long enough to see what the future holds. That's probably not exactly the answer you were looking for, but I have personally great faith in both our soldiers and the leadership behind them that we will remain the strong Force that we've been all along, and that we do so through strong leadership, good training, and the best education that's out there.
I've heard it said that there are people who are saying that you don't want to be the next country, the nation, the next nation state that pisses the U.S. off, because we may look, we may send out a Force that's minus a few fingers, toes, eyeballs, arms, and legs, but they are going to be really mean and have a lot of experience and will know what to do when the shooting starts. Your thoughts on that?
I don't know if I'd say, if I'd use the term mean, but I will tell you that, and I think we all recognize it, that the one thing that comes out of such an extended period of conflict is you have a seasoned Force across all cohorts. whether they be junior enlisted to the senior leadership level, even our civilians, they're all seasoned, and we know how to fight, and we know how to dig deep within ourselves and fight for a long haul. So I would say probably for the next generation, at least the next decade, that's the force that the world sees, is they, you know, that probably the most experienced combat force in the world by far. And that will carry it through. Is when I entered the Army in the early 90s, I could still look across the force and see the vestiges of the Vietnam War that were still in uniform, and what terrific respect I had for them. And I think that over the course of the next generation, they're going to, new enlistees and newly commissioned officers are going to see the same thing. They're going to look across the force and see these seasoned people that have a tremendous amount of experience behind them, and that will drive the character of the force as we build towards what the future will hold.
You bring up this point of when you were a young Army soldier, and you guys, of course, had real touchstones, guys like Barry McCaffrey, Freddie Franks, Don Starry, and God knows how many great NCOs who survived that whole period. And you could look to them and literally touch them and know they'd been there. They'd seen what was possible. What did that mean to you as a young soldier when you were first getting in?
That made the difference between whether I stayed and whether I pursued a different course in my career. And my first experience was, I barely had a year in the Army and found myself in Saudi Arabia preparing for the 91 Gulf War. And I had mixed feelings about what the future held for me at that point in time. But I could look at the very people that you mentioned, the Barry McCaffreys, the Benny Pease, and see an army arrayed across the desert, and it was a touchstone moment in my life, that I went from being someone who wasn't sure what I wanted to do in the future to someone who was inspired to make that my career. Because I wanted to follow in their footsteps. I wanted to do in the military what they had done during their careers. And it was a very different kind of moment. And it also caused me to reevaluate my own career goals, because I came in with very limited career goals into that period of conflict, and stepped away from it with a completely different perspective. And that's the same perspective that I brought into the deployments for OEF and OIF early on in the century, was that same. It would almost come full circle, where I found myself, even as a junior field grade officer, to be able to look around at people who hadn't done the same thing, and they looked to us in the same light, that there's some seasoned veterans here. Where do we link up with them? How do we draw from their experience? And you see us 13 years later, and we have that across the force now. I think that's a very powerful thing.
As you sit here today and you look at the force, and as you write about it and comment on it, if you could pick a couple of things you'd want to do across the force, and I'm talking for the not just the force itself, but the entire enterprise that is the Department of Defense, what would you do for the people who make the sacrifices they do to work for the Department of Defense, to be in the military? What would you want to do for them? Not necessarily even as a thank you, but just to make their lives a little easier and a little better.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think that most of us probably share the same sentiment that I do. It's a feeling that I get when I pass through an airport, or I see somebody on the street and I'm in uniform and they thank me for my service. And it's a different feeling that I get, because I do this because I believe in what we do, and I think that the reward that I get from my service is reward enough. And I used to say something to my children when they were younger that what I get from this, from serving our country, is the ability to look in the mirror every day and say, I make a difference. And I tell them that all their lives, that that's something that they should strive for. You want a career that allows you to do that, because as long as you're making a difference, you know that what you're doing is important, and that matters. And that's something that not a lot of professions offer. And it's something that you look at what we do. I don't want anything else from the public. I don't want, you know, I don't even need people to thank me for my service. I feel like that service, the thanks I get, is the ability to look in the mirror every day and know that what I'm doing matters to somebody, and it makes a difference for our country. And that has motivated me throughout more than 20 years of doing this, is knowing that it makes a difference and it counts. And so if I had to do anything, or if I had to say anything, I would only ask, look inside, and then look around you. And all those people, that gratitude that you receive, they may not know what they're thanking you for, but in the end, they're thanking you for making a difference for the country in your own way, in your own time. And I think that's reward enough.
Let's talk about a couple of other more topical things that are floating around town here. The buzz du jour this morning here in the Beltway area, in the Washington, D.C. area, is that the COCOMs, the major combatant commands, may be once again realigned, juggled, or even a couple of them gotten rid of. Explain to our listeners what the rationale for this is, and what are your thoughts on this idea? Good, bad, really stupid? What do you think?
I know about the same thing everybody else does. I read what was in the news over the weekend, and I look at it like I do, like we all should anything, and that's that we're entering a period of change, and so nothing should be sacred at this point. And even the alignment of the geographic combatant commands, we should look at them from time to time. And there's value in doing that. This process may result in a validation of the current construct, that the way the combatant commands are laid out today may be the right way, but they may not be. And there's aspects of how those combatant commands are structured in terms of their geographic responsibilities that we should look at. The alignment, say, I saw one of the points made was that you have Pakistan and Afghanistan that fall within the CENTCOM area of responsibility, and India falls over into the Pacific Command. And yet I think everyone recognizes the need for those three countries, because of the intense interaction between those three countries, they need to be covered and probably in a single area of responsibility. The same with when you look at NORTHCOM and SOUTHCOM, that there's issues within Central and South America that need to be addressed that are split across two COCOMs, where that may not make sense. And so I think there's great value in taking the time to revalidate how we look at problems like this and how we organize ourselves to deal with a changing world. I think that's a necessary part of the machine, for lack of a better term. If you don't go back in and fine-tune it every so often, then you run the risk of becoming static, and that's not a good thing. So I look at this, and I think this is as good a time as any to do it, and I think it's a good idea.
I mean, is a top-to-bottom reorganization good, desirable, or should we just sit down and take a good hard look at ourselves and think for a while? I mean...
I think you do both simultaneously. I think you do the broad brushstroke of across all the combatant commands to look at them and to determine where you can make changes. But at the same time, I'm sure that there'll be structural changes. This is a point in time with the current fiscal environment where it is the time to look where you have possible inefficiencies or redundancies within organizations, where you can consolidate functions. There's opportunities to improve the efficiencies across the board. And I think that all happens right now, and I think it all happens within this time frame. And it's as good as time as any to do it. And so, yeah, I think you get a top-to-bottom review. At the same time, you look across the broad brush scope of what they do.
Now, you wouldn't be Doctrine Man if you weren't making fun of things at some point. And let's face it, right now the elephant in the room, at least here in the D.C. metro area, if not all through the defense enterprise, is the issue of sequestration. And I'd just like to have you talk a little bit about how has this provided you subject matter, fodder, whatever you want to call it, for what Doctrine Man's been saying, both in the strip as well as in the blog. What are the things that you found that are absurd about this entire process that you could make good fun of and maybe make us all think about why we'd like to get out of it?
Well, I tell you, I wouldn't want to call it absurd, but the one piece of sequester that has actually there's more than one, but the I would say what's provided the most fodder for humor, sadly, has been the furlough. And it's that dark humor, gallows humor, if you will, that has driven a number of cartoons over the past few months. Probably more so because having up close and personal experience with this now for the past 6 weeks, what we've seen is that the unfortunate decision to pursue a civilian furlough had a secondary effect that I'm not sure everybody had got to see, but it was the idea that you take the civilian workforce out 20% of the time. So one in every 5 days we send the folks home. But I would say that what made the humor the darkest was the fact that what we really found out was our civilians contribute a lot more than 20%. And that 20% probably had an impact to mission probably closer to 50%, and that's just a guess. But taking them out one day a week probably hampered us the other 4 days of the week and as well, because they're so integral to what we do, especially when you move – the further you move away from the tactical army – the brigade and below army, the further you move away from that, the greater an impact the civilian workforce has. But that's where most of our civilians are at, whether they're in schools, whether they're in centers of excellence, whether they're in the Pentagon. And they are so integral to what we do that when you pull them out for one day, it has a ripple effect that you feel the other 4 days of the week, both in terms of anticipating the fact that they're going to be gone, so you try to get the most out of them you can for the other 4 days, to that one day where you basically have to tread water without them. And I think that the ridiculousness of it all, it was a way to save money. We recognize that. Nobody wanted to do this. But the good piece of all this was if there was ever a question of how invaluable our civilians are to us, we answered it over the last 6 weeks. That you won't find anybody today who questioned that 6 weeks ago who would not say, "Yep, I don't want to go through that one again," because none of us do.
The flip side of that, what have you been able to extract from both the many years of continuing resolutions and the sequester? What kinds of things has that provided you for cartoon material? I mean, how do you visually go in your Doctrine Man cartoons portray the real world aspects of the continuing resolution and the sequester, or can you?
Yeah, you can. I haven't tried that because that tends to be more political than anything. And as much as we can, we try to stay out of the political arena. I mean, it bleeds over into what we do. So you might see some political discussion in the mini blog forum, but within the cartoons itself, we try not to dive too deep into that, because frankly, that's a quagmire I don't think we could dig ourselves back out of.
Which takes us to an interesting question. You obviously live within this world of the military. I mean, like me, you are a professional in your chosen trade, and you have bosses and lines of authority. Do they know you are Doctrine Man, and what do they think of it? Do they mind?
Well, that's a really good question. I have not worked for anyone over the course of the past several years who didn't know and who didn't accept it. And I don't think any of them mind. The challenge is to be able to have fun and you don't cross the line between a little bit of humor and disrespect. And that's something that challenges an awful lot of people, because you see people that write or portray things that are outright disrespectful to our leaders. And I'm not a believer in that, not in any way, shape, or form, because I think there's plenty of ways to express yourself or express your discontent without crossing that line. And that's that in and of itself is a challenge. And so I think what that does, though, is knowing that within your command you have somebody like me who does the humor and runs the discussion site, is the amount of trust that they have that they don't have to worry about Dr. Man crossing a specific line, because I might toe the line, but I won't cross it. And it's because, and I won't typically tolerate it amongst the discussion forums either, because that's a line that you shouldn't cross. And that's something that you learn over the years, is that it's okay to express your discontent. And I actually had a boss one time who used to talk in terms of phase one and phase two. And most of what we discuss is in phase one, which means you're open to all that discussion. But once the decision's been made, you move into phase two, the discussions, the questions, the complaints, all of it stops. Because you have a period, and we, within most of these discussion areas, stay within what we call phase one, where you can have open discussion, disagreement. It's respectful, it's focused, and it's clean in terms of how you express discontent or disagreement. But once those decisions have been made, it's kind of move on. And I think that allows you to have that discussion. And my bosses have always recognized the fact that at least when it comes time to, in terms of what I do, that I won't cross that line.
Your friends and family, I assume, know exactly what you are in your secret life here. Coworkers, other people, they know as well. And I guess my question is, how is it you've managed to keep the secret pretty much? I mean, I was talking with Carl Prine over the weekend, who did, I believe, an interview with you a while back, and we all have taken this vow of keeping your name, your actual name and identity secret. How do you keep that going? I mean, is it part of the mystery and motif of Doctrine Man that we've all come into?
You know, it's probably the worst kept secret within the Beltway or even within our circles. Plenty of people know. People figure it out. There are ways that you can look, and there's hints dropped here and there. Carl figured it out pretty quick. Really, when it comes down to it, the whole idea of a secret identity was a gag. And I looked at it from if you look at Superman, and, okay, you never see Superman and Clark Kent in the same place. Clark Kent puts those glasses on. Nobody knows it's him. It's the same kind of thing. That people know it's me. They either know it from the sense of humor. They know it how I write. They can tell from the way I express myself that, okay, hey, I know that guy. But it's the gag of, okay, now I got my glasses on. You can't really tell it's me. And other than that, everyone generally respects there's a certain desire to remain anonymous, not because I'm worried about how I express myself or what I say. It's really more of a privacy thing, and that's how I generally describe it to people, because the amount of traffic that comes through that microblog site, it can be phenomenal at times, and it would be a lot worse if people knew who I was. Because then that would bleed over into other things. And by maintaining a secret identity, I get to keep the Clark Kent gag going. But at the same time, it also helps to limit some traffic.
Let's go back to a big question real quick, and I'm going to give you a little rope here to go ahead and tie whatever knot you'd like to with it. Hopefully not a noose. What do you wish America, the country, would do with its military as we move into the middle of the 21st century? I mean, here we are at a crossroads. We're finishing up one set of conflicts, for better or for worse. What would you, as an American, want us to do with the military?
I would say, and I've given this some thought over time, what we need to be allowed to do is we're in a period where fiscal realities are going to drive us to a smaller force of some size at some point in time. What my hope would be for our nation's leaders would be to give us the time necessary to build down to the size of force that we need. If we hurry cuts, then what somebody once told me was, if you want a bad, you get it bad. And there's an inherent danger in that. If you allow the military, and not just the Army, but all the services, to take the time to design the force that the nation needs in accordance with a national security strategy, you give the services time to build down to that capability, as opposed to just cutting to a certain size. You know, we still have the targets that are necessary, and then we build down to those. We build a force structure that has those capabilities, and we take the time to do it right. So when the nation needs to call on those capabilities, they'll be there, and they'll be both effective and efficient. And that's what my wish would be.
We've got about 5 minutes left before I know you have to take off, but let's talk a little bit about the future of Doctrine Man. Have you started thinking about what you will do with Doctrine Man in the months and years ahead?
Oh, well, that's a tough question. I don't tend to think more than about 6 months out right now. The realities of day-to-day duties keep me from doing that. So I tend to look out about 6 months. I can tell you that in 6 months from now, we're going to have a second book out with the second year of cartoons. We're going to continue to evolve characters and ideas. But what you see on a day-to-day basis is very much kind of a go with the flow. We'll look at a situation, we'll try to gauge, you know, build cartoons around what's going on in the world. So that very much makes it difficult to look out long term. Ideally, what we'd like to do is syndicate and get into a position where when the day comes, when we actually hang up our spurs and take the uniform off, that this becomes what we do on a full-time basis, which I think there's plenty to suggest that there's enough news, there's enough key discussion areas that we could maintain this on a full-time basis outside the military, and probably in a much more effective way. Because as it sits today, my time allows me about 2 hours a day to do what we do. And you typically get a half an hour in the morning, half an hour at lunchtime, and an hour in the evening. And that's about all the time we have. And it looks like a tremendous amount of flow during the day, but if you pay real close attention, it's very focused around that first cup of coffee after PT, what happens at lunchtime over a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and what happens at night while we watch Seinfeld reruns. And so that's how we gauge our time. So to make a short answer to your question, it would be the future would be to take this thing to a syndicated cartoon and be able to do this full time with audiences.
That would be an amazing transition from what started as a simple notion of sharing a little office humor to becoming something like that. And yet, it seems like you're well on the way. I mean, you've got the basic construct. And when you talk about the idea of syndication, it occurs to me it's been a very long time since America has had a serious comic strip or even an editorial type of visual strip
that deals with the military. I mean, how long has it been since Bill Malden was, you know, doing Willie and Joe? And yet those cartoons are how we define big parts of our history, World War II and such.
Yeah.
Do you feel inspiration from the people who have done those kinds of cartoons before you?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't say anything but that. Absolutely. You know, I've spent my time with Willie and Joe, and you know, a lot of us grew up on that type of entertainment. So, absolutely.
And you certainly are a variation on the original theme that Beetle Bailey had, of course.
A variation, definitely.
An intriguing variation, to say the least. I know you're coming up on the end of the time you can spend with us. What else would you like to talk about or say to our listeners as we wrap this up?
All I would say was continue to tune in, continue to join in the dialogue, and the best is yet to come.
Sir, I'd like to thank you for coming on. I know you've had limited time, but let's have you get back on someday and talk a little more about other things that are important, because this has been a great, great time for me, and I really appreciate it.
Sounds like a plan, John, and we'll plan for a full hour next time.
That'd be great, sir. Take your time, have a great day, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Take care, John.
You too, sir. And with that, we come to the end of another hour, almost hour, of Military Monday. I hope you enjoyed the chance to talk, you know, let us talk with Dr. Mann. I hope you'll also go and see his work on his Facebook page, Doctrine Man, all one word. He also is on Twitter as Doctrine_Man. He is prolific in what he posts, and I think you're going to enjoy watching him, especially as we go into these kinds of discussions of what America's military is going to look like in the months and years ahead. And with that, I'm going to say thank you for listening to Military Monday. It's been a great time, and I'll talk to you next Monday at 1 p.m. Thank you.